President Rogers, Professor Montoya, friends, thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a particular pleasure to be here, considering that it was not entirely easy to get here. A posse had to be dispatched to DFW Airport to collect me after I was unable to make the one available flight to Wichita Falls. But it was done very efficiently. I want to begin tonight on a timeless theme, which is the role that language plays, can play, in conditioning our thought, especially on matters relating to economics. This is not something that economists are taught explicitly in graduate schools, at least so far as I know, but some of them become very good at it, nevertheless. A kind of hidden literary aspect of what, for most people, is a forbiddingly technical topic. And the valence and connotations that certain words and concepts carry often have more power over policy than the actual analysis that is attached to them. That is to say, our policy reaction, we're moved to do in response to certain aspects of economics, often has more to do with the way we react to the words than with the way economists, when they're thinking carefully, construct and analyze the problems. Notorious and perhaps canonical example was the use by Karl Marx of the term capitalism to describe the system as a whole, a word which conveyed the idea of domination and control over the system by its central actor, the capitalist, and of course raised a question about the legitimacy of that position. In post-war America, in the years when I was growing up, this usage was countered with the phrase mixed economy, a term which captured the ideas and institutions that had been brought to America and brought into American politics by the New Deal. And in our more recent generation, we have the even less subtle term, the free market economy, with its very clear implication that policy debates in economics are really about freedom, and freedom is something you can favor or oppose, but if you oppose it, well, good luck to you. I would like to say, let us consider, in the context that I want to discuss tonight, namely the great crisis through which we have been passing in recent years, the more prosaic word recession. Economics actually has many words to describe nasty events. Slump, panic, depression, crisis. But in the aftermath of what happened in the fall, late fall of 2008, most economists and practically the entire body of official usage fell in behind the phrase Great Recession to describe what was going on. And the effect, I suggest, is to reassure. Recessions are not like depressions. Why? Recessions are temporary. They are always followed by recoveries. And so if we speak of a great recession, it must surely be implied that there will come sooner or later, and perhaps sooner than later, a great recovery. That, I think, is the point of choosing and emphasizing that particular phrase. Or, to turn to a diagnostic issue, let's consider the word bubble to describe the events that led up to the crisis. What is a bubble? A bubble is a mechanical process involving a slow buildup and a quick collapse. Okay, so far so good, no problem with that. But the word also conveys superficiality. When a bubble pops, you're back to where you started. The previous conditions are restored. A bubble by itself popping does not destroy things. It does not make matters worse. There is even an aspect of childish innocence about it. Bubbles necessarily pop. They're made to pop. When they do pop, who can be blamed? A final example, and I could multiply them, but these three I think will do to set up the argument I want to make. Let's take the word deficit. The word deficit surely conveys a deficiency. Normality surely is conveyed by the concept of balance. And a positive or superior performance is captured by the value that we would associate normally with the term surplus. Surplus is good, balances are okay, deficits are surely deficient. Where do these ideas come from? They are actually rooted in the 17th century doctrine known as mercantilism, as applied to international trade, where the idea was that a country accumulated treasure, gold and silver, by running a trade surplus. If it ran a trade deficit, it would be weakened with respect to its enemies. It also has a certain correspondence to commercial accounting, profits and loss. But neither of these things is sufficient to persuade, or should be sufficient to persuade us, that a deficit that is incurred by the federal government of a large country is per se an evil that must be combated. If it were, one would have to ask, how is it the case that the history of the United States is full of deficits, going back to 1790, with only very brief periods of surpluses? How is it the case that we've come through more than 200 years of running deficits without having had a financial collapse of the government of the United States? Nevertheless, however you may think about these things in dispassionate and analytical terms, if you choose to make that argument, as I have tried to do, you discover that anyone arguing that deficits are normal and on occasion desirable finds themselves swimming upstream against a very strong current of skepticism. It's also true that the concepts I've just mentioned, play an extraordinarily powerful role, that have tended to dominate the discussion of the events through which we have recently lived. That is to say, one hears a repetitive discussion of the problem of the bubble, which then burst, giving us the Great Recession and the resulting problem of the budget deficit, which then becomes the policy focus that must be solved. And I want to suggest to you that all three of these concepts taken together present a highly misleading picture. And that what tonight we ought to do is try to set them aside, central though they are, and consider two other ideas that they have largely displaced, that generally speaking are not taken to be the central issues that we have to deal with when thinking about the Great Crisis, but that I suggest to you are, in fact, fairly fundamental. First of these concepts is resource costs, the costs of resources. And the second one, which for reasons I will explain, I think is closely related and follows on logically, is the problem of financial fraud. I grew up in an economics profession, or grew into an economics profession, in the 1970s that had been very strongly dominated by the intellectuals of the 1950s, who in turn developed models of economic growth that, in which the problem of resources basically did not figure at all. And there was a reason for that. It was a time when resources for the United States were very cheap, and they played, in fact, a very small role in our picture of the economy, particularly if you were looking at it from the vantage point of Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Chicago, Illinois, a very long way from the resource-producing regions, and particularly the energy-producing regions around here. There was, in these models, there were labor, there was capital. Land, which in classical political economy had captured at least one of the aspects of the resource problem, diminishing returns, had largely been set aside, was no longer important because of the diminishing role of agriculture. And there was a belief, fostered by the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, experience of those years, that in any event, technical change could overcome all emergent difficulties. It was a very happy world, and economists of my generation were conditioned to believe that it could continue forever. And we had the rather rude experience of being educated in the 1970s when it became clear that it couldn't continue forever. And we were confronted with the first resource-based problems of the post-war period. Something which ought to have changed our thinking, but didn't. Why? Because for reasons I'll come to in a moment, in the 1980s, the problems appeared to go away, and we persuaded ourselves once again that there were policies that could keep them in abeyance indefinitely. In a broader view of history, I think we may realize that the arc of American prosperity over the full 20th century was very closely tied to oil. In the beginning, as it came on stream in large quantities, oil transformed our agricultural system, transformed our food supply, changed our transportation system entirely, gave us military power in the Second World War that went far beyond what had been available to us in the First World War, partly through shipping, of course very heavily through aviation. And then in the post-war period, gave us an entirely different and new way of life based on the automobile and the suburb. And this is what began to fade in 1970. When the
the age of cheap onshore domestically produced petroleum reached that turning point, which is called Hubbert's Peak, the point at which total production began slowly to decline. It wasn't a peak in global oil production. It wasn't even a peak in American oil production, but it did mean that the cost of this critical resource was destined to rise, and the marginal source was going to move offshore to the Gulf of Mexico, to Alaska, to Venezuela, to the Middle East. And of course, in 1973, we lost control of the price. From that point, and for the rest of that decade, the economy was beset by uncertainties that everyone understood were related to this problem. The oil shocks in 1973, 1979, with the Iranian Revolution, the uncertainties over price, uncertainties over supply, whether the physical product would actually be available, social conflict over who would have access on preferred terms to diminished resources, that social conflict showing up as wage inflation, and policy uncertainties over how the government would respond were all part of the mix that made that decade a very unpleasant one. And by 1980, the picture was very dark. And then in 1980, as we all remember, we're old enough, along came Ronald Reagan. What did Reagan do? Well, he dampened internal social conflict by a decisive attack on the power of the trade unions, which as collateral damage also demolished much of the American heavy manufacturing sector. And we remember that. But on the external front, he also changed America's relationship to the world in ways that were not as visible to people living here at the time. Along with the Federal Reserve, interest rates were raised dramatically. The United States became an assertive user of its financial power. The growth of the commodity-producing countries of the Third World was largely collapsed. World commodity prices fell, and ultimately the same pressure of debt and commodity prices told very heavily on our principal geopolitical rival of that time, the Soviet Union, which fell apart at the end of that decade. And so in this period, and with very little overt military conflict, the Reagan team reestablished the sense of America as the world's great superpower, while at the same time financing the American economy on the strength of what we'll call debt, but what was also the willingness of the rest of the world to hold American financial assets, to hold dollars, to hold US Treasury bonds and bills as the global financial reserve. In other words, to supply us with goods and services for which we were not required to pay, except insofar as we were acting as the guarantor of global political and economic stability. And although at the time I was a young member of the congressional staff, I was the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee, and vigorously opposed on a day-to-day basis to practically everything the Reagan administration was doing, looking back at it in retrospect, one has to admit that from a purely national standpoint, this was a massively successful assertion of national economic and financial power, and one which carried over for at least another decade, from which the Clinton administration benefited enormously. The Clinton administration extended this to its, I think, feasible limits. There was, in those years, the 1990s, following a recession that, of course, destroyed the political prospects of the first Bush administration, a new wave of growth. What was it based on? It was based on two things. It was based on financial liberalization and volatility in the outside world, leading to crises in Mexico in 1995, in Asia in 1997, in Russia in 1998, and from all of these things, a flow of capital, of finance to the safe haven of the United States, making financial conditions here easier than they otherwise would have been. And secondly, of course, as we all remember, on the great apparent promise in those years of information technology. A technical revolution, which was partly real, gave us a transformation which is still going on in almost all of our productive capacities and lives, but also partly make-believe, based in part upon business models which were, in many cases, inherently implausible, could never be satisfied, but which were nevertheless generously financed. And what happened was that you had a lot of investment, a lot of employment, and a lot of prosperity that stemmed from the fact that people were doing something, even if that something wasn't going to be successful in the long run. And of course it wasn't, and the boom ended with a resounding crash in the year 2000. Leaving the next administration, the administration of President George W. Bush, with a very daunting challenge, which was, how does one continue to present the American people with the impression, and indeed the experience, of prosperity, economic growth, and profitability in an environment where you can no longer rely exclusively on your external financial power, no longer rely on this mood of business make-believe that had played itself out over the preceding two decades? And I think that was the problem that the Bush team faced, particularly since they were a very energy-oriented administration who understood that the successful extraction of higher priced and higher cost oil in Canada, South America, and elsewhere required higher prices. Well, there were a number of answers to this that didn't work very well. The tax cuts worked for a little while, the war in Iraq that gave a little boost in 2003. But what carried out through this entire decade was make-believe in a different part of the economy, and that was housing finance. Make-believe that I think is only reasonably characterized as financial fraud. Indeed, the largest wave of financial fraud in human history. And fraud was not, in this area, an incidental phenomenon. It was an essential underpinning of economic growth in this area of the economy. Why was that so? The answer is very simple. Housing in the United States was something that we had learned to do better than any country in the world. We had, since the 1930s, built up very strong and essentially stable institutions to provide mortgage loans to families so they could own their own houses. And by the year 2000, we had over 60% of our population living in homes that they owned. It was a mature sector. It was a sector where loans that were made to people who could repay the loans essentially had already been made. And there would be some growth, but it could never be rapid. A mature sector cannot, in its nature, grow rapidly. So a new market had to be developed. And what could that be? If you could not grow rapidly by making loans that were going to be repaid, well, There was another option out there, and that was to grow rapidly by making loans that were not going to be repaid. This was a market with intrinsically infinite potential. And as it grew, to come back to the theme of language, an entire language developed in the industry to describe it. There were liar's loans, technically called Alt-A mortgages, that were made to people who were told not to document their incomes. They were also made to people with non-existent or bad credit histories. They were made against houses that were appraised in an inflated way by appraisers who were pressured to do that to justify a larger loan than the house could carry on the market. There were loans with teaser rates that would be raised to a market rate after 2 or 3 years. These were known in the industry as neutron loans, a nuclear term. It means that when the things exploded, the people would be destroyed, but the houses would still be intact. The loans, of course, were bundled and securitized, divided into tranches and sold off. And the lowest tranche, the equity tranche that was typically held by the bank, was called the toxic waste. The toxic waste. I ask you to imagine a restaurant where the waitstaff refer to the food as sewage, sludge, and crud. You would have to acknowledge that in that situation, the employees were probably aware that the business that they were in was not 100% honest. I'll try out a different characterization of this in terms of language. What were these documents that were being created largely in the private financial sector by mortgage originators like Ameriquest, IndyMac is a bank, but Ameriquest or Countrywide Financial, and had these properties that the documentation was missing, abusive, fraudulent, the appraisals were overstated, and so forth. These documents looked like mortgages. They said mortgage on them. But I submit to you that they were not mortgages, that they were really counterfeits. They were the exact equivalent of a counterfeit bill. Something made to resemble the real thing, but in important respects, not genuine. Now, when you produce counterfeit bills on a large scale, you have to bring them in to the legitimate market by getting them certified genuine. This is a process called laundering. And that was the job of the ratings agencies. What the ratings agencies did in this business was to transform a loan that was going to default with practically 100% certainty into a security, or a bundle of such loans, into a security that could carry the rating AAA, which was widely believed to mean as good as United States government debt. That's laundering. And then these laundered securities have to be sold into the legitimate market. There is a term for this. It's called fencing. And that is what the investment banks and the commercial banks do. And then finally, someone has to be found who will take the bad paper and swallow it. Right? And there is equally a term for this. It's called the mark. And who is the mark in this situation? Well, if you read Michael Lewis's very important book, The Big Short, there's a little passage in which one of the traders says to another, who's buying this stuff anyway? And the response comes back, Dusseldorf. Dusseldorf. And what that tells you, Dusseldorf was the headquarters of one of the major German banks that failed as a result of its exposure to toxic American mortgages. But more broadly, what that tells you is that the crisis that we generated here is also the crisis that occurred in Europe. because so much of these overpriced, essentially valueless and fraudulent securities that are so tainted by fraud that they can never be marketed to a dispassionate investor, ended up in the hands of European financial institutions. When they realized how much losses they were taking, they sought to reduce their exposure to vulnerable sovereign debts that they also held, and started selling off Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain. And that is what, beginning in 2009, began to precipitate the ongoing European financial crisis. There's another aspect to this, which I'll mention only briefly, even though it's part of the title of my talk. And that is, as this sector came to dominate the overall measured growth of the American economy, it also came to dominate incomes. And if you look at how American incomes were distributed across regions, places, and industries in this time, what you discover is that the growth of incomes in the financial sector drives the whole show. The very substantial part of the rise in measured inequality in these years is exactly this process. Which tells you, essentially, that you have two sides of a balance sheet at play here. The fees and incomes that are being generated and recorded, and the profits that are being recorded as a result of the growth of a lot of financial activity on the one side, and the debts that underlie those fees and profits on the other. And the fees and the profits went to rich people, and the debts by and large went to much poorer people. And the result is not only a vast increase in inequality, but also a fundamental instability, which assures that the whole exercise is going to come to a crashing end. And it's not a bubble in the sense I described earlier, because when it crashes, things do not return to the previous condition. They are fundamentally changed. The previous structures are broken, and I will argue they cannot be repaired. Well, that all, of course, happened in the late fall, well, beginning in August of 2007, but culminating in the late fall of 2008, already now 3.25 years ago. And we have to confront our reaction as a country, as a policy-making country, as a set of institutions to this calamity. In particular, I think we have to confront the way professional economists reacted to it. Because I think my profession, which carries an enormous burden of influence in these matters, took two of their most flawed instincts into this situation. One of them was the presumption of innocence, which I'm all in favor of in a courtroom, but not in the face of the overwhelming evidence that one observes here. The presumption of innocence led economists to believe that the institutions of the financial system could essentially be repaired, or would recover if only allowed time. It led them to believe that with a little bit of ingenuity, at least for a while, that you could recreate markets in these mortgages and other assets which had been exposed as disastrously flawed. This wasn't true. Secondly, and I think closely related actually, the economists brought to the crisis a propensity to believe that the economy was a self-stabilizing system, that things would return to normal. This comes back to the use of the word recession that I mentioned at the beginning of my talk. It was a close counterpart of that usage in the technical models that economists had, on which projections were based into 2009, and even more recently than that, projections made, for example, by the Congressional Budget Office, which showed the unemployment rate going right back to 5%, and the economy recovering quite rapidly over 4 or 5 years. If that's built into the model, even though there's no policy foundation for making it happen, but simply because of an assumption about the natural resilience of the economy, then if that assumption is wrong, policy is going to be led down a fundamentally wrong, overly optimistic path. And I think there was a third thing associated with this, which was a desire on the part of economic policymakers to return as quickly as possible to subjects with which they were in fact familiar, like healthcare reform, rather than forcing themselves to confront the grim and unprecedented character of the events that they actually faced. Another word which crept into usage here, in spite of my violent opposition, admittedly my opposition, violent or otherwise, doesn't count for much, was the word stimulus, which was reflexively, a label reflexively assigned to those of us who advocated a strong policy in response to the crisis. What is a stimulus? Again, think about the power of the word. Stimulus is a medical term. It connotes a little injection of adrenaline or amphetamine, to get an otherwise healthy organism moving again, right? It conveys all of that in the word, a temporary measure that will restore vigor to the body economic. It's not a recommend something you would recommend for organ failure. If you have a situation where surgery is required, stimulus is not the right metaphorical description of the policy. And yet I suggest that that metaphor had an enormous amount of power with the policymakers in the Obama administration, who were not willing to break out of it to say, no, look, the problem is more serious than this. We have institutions, banks in particular, household sector debts, which everybody could see had fundamentally failed, and we need to do something about that. No, that's not the way they approached it. And the result was a cobbling together of half measures, some increase in public spending, some cuts in taxes, some minor financial reforms, or the appearance of financial reform, or to cover up the fact that financial reform was in fact not happening, and a great disappointment of the performance of the economy with respect to the forecast. Things much worse than expected. The only people making out well were, of course, the bankers. Everybody else was heading straight toward foreclosure and unemployment. For months and months and months after they had been told that things should be turning around. A political disaster, but also, I suggest to you, an intellectual disaster, because it gave rise to what I'll call an explosion of crack pottery. Every hobby horse you could possibly imagine, some of them professional, some of them less so, some of them lobby-driven, gets interjected willy-nilly into the debate in the last several years. The worst offenders are the well-organized propagandists, which I'll call the deficit hysterics, those who suggest that the United States is going to become Greece. These people do not know anything about the United States, and they certainly do not know anything about Greece. And they have not perhaps heard that a difference between the United States and Greece is that our central bank is in our national capital and Greece's central bank is in Germany. There are those, and this was at the Federal Reserve, there are those who continue to argue that if only the Federal Reserve would pump in money and get the inflation rate up, that that would solve our problems, overlooking the fact that Japan had been unable to perform the same magic for 20 solid years, and overlooking the fact that the Federal Reserve tried it very extensively in 2009, 2010, with no effect whatever. Overlooking the fact, really, that giving banks reserves does not make them more anxious to lend. Banks are not money lenders and do not need money in order to lend. Or those who argued that this was all a matter of regulation and uncertainty over government policy, a truly fantastic view, not connected to any real phenomenon in the world, but something that you can say if you have an agenda to get rid of some body of regulation that you don't happen to like, for example, the new healthcare law, which, because it has not gone into effect, can hardly be accused of actually wrecking the economy, so it must be uncertainty over its future effects that's doing this. If you can believe that, you are capable of constructing belief structures that will account for anything in any convenient way. There are those, and the president was in this camp in his State of the Union, who started to turn attention to manufacturing with a whole plethora of tax breaks addressed to that supposed core of the crisis. Policy to restore manufacturing. Another, I think, will of the wisp, and I can talk about that at greater length, and I won't do it right now, but one which fundamentally overlooks two realities. One is that whatever will happen in manufacturing will happen on a global scale, and it is not within our power to control how manufacturing develops in a country like China. Simply, it's a big country, it's far from us, and we don't run it. And secondly, that the crisis was clearly not a manufacturing crisis, it was a financial crisis. Discussion of what to do about manufacturing is not going to cure a problem which has its origins in a collapse of confidence in finance. And there's a new body of discussion about tax reform, which we're hearing more and more. In fact, Larry Summers jumped on it today with an article in the Financial Times, which again, I suggest, is just another grasping at straws by highly reputable and influential people who simply are not prepared to analyze the problem we have and would therefore much prefer to analyze or present the solutions that they offered 15 or 20 years ago to some other entirely different problem. What do we have to do? And I'll wrap up here reasonably quickly. It seems to me that if I'm right, we have two issues that we ought to be thinking about very seriously. One is how to cope with a world in which the cost, the real cost of obtaining resources, is going to be higher and more unstable, essentially indefinitely. Partly because the physical resources are harder to get, and partly because we don't control them. And I would suggest that a strategic approach to restructuring the economy must begin with that problem. Obviously, a miracle source of cheap energy, natural gas, for example, would go a long way to resolving that issue of putting it off for a long time, and that would be great. Failing that, we have to deal with the fact that the structure we have for using energy in the 21st century cannot be successfully the same one we had in the middle of the 20th century when our oil was onshore, domestic, and cheap. A combination of how we produce energy and how we use it has to be part of a strategy, and that has to be something that we develop in a way that enables us to rebuild the country along viable lines over 25 years, let's say. And secondly, let's recognize the fact that if we think of the economy as a single integrated operating system, a business if you like, the current overhead in the financial sector is far too large. Banks are very large fixed costs on the economy, and they need to justify their existence by serving a function that's useful to businesses and to individuals. With the collapse of the mortgage markets and with the unwillingness of banks to underwrite loans to businesses, it's very hard to see what that is. You have them on every street corner. They pay their chief executives enormous salaries. They have vast political influence in the Congress and executive branch. They provide jobs to leading politicians, I imagine, of both parties, but certainly the Democratic administration currently in power, once they've left office. And in this way, they have a big grip on the life and policy thinking of the country. And if that grip is not broken, we are not going to have freed up the real resources that we need to make all of our lives better and to provide employment and to create a new sphere, a new type of prosperity. So to me, those two issues have to be the centerpiece of coherent thinking about where we go. And in the meantime, I would suggest that there are some things that we could do with tools that we already have that would just make our lives easier and give the population a sense of progress moving forward. I'll just mention three of them. One of them is a suggestion, it's not mine, a colleague of mine in Washington, for what he calls a right to rent law to deal with this vast problem of foreclosures and evictions and homeless home losses that's currently going on. The idea would be to say that if you're foreclosed in your house, the foreclosure process goes through, but you have a right to stay in the house at a fair rent for, let's say, 3 years, and then to buy the house back, you have a first option if the circumstances improve. And the idea would be two things. It would preserve neighborhoods by keeping people who want to stay in their houses in them. Obviously, many people are not in that position, but that would help those who are. And it would give banks who do not wish to become landlords an incentive to actually modify the mortgages before the foreclosure process, rather than the present situation where they have the incentive to drag things out and the housing market never reaches a point of clearing. It's a simple suggestion, in other words, a institutional change that would help change or redress the balances of power in the economy. A second one that I've proposed is a rise in the minimum wage, a very substantial rise in the minimum wage. And the idea here, we could talk about the effects on employment, is that this would principally raise the income of low-income workers and give employers an incentive to hire more Americans as opposed to undocumented immigrants. Because if you raise the wage, the jobs become more attractive, it's possible to recruit in the domestic population. Third idea, something I've argued from the beginning of the crisis, is to recognize the fact that the crisis has put us in a kind of demographic transition, where people my age, even a little younger, who have worked hard jobs, not easy ones like mine, but real jobs, for 30 years, are ready to quit, but cannot do so because they haven't quite reached the Social Security minimum retirement age, or because they can't qualify, they're not qualified for Medicare, and they need the health insurance. I would sweeten the terms. I would do, Mr. President, every university does, when you have an aged and alcoholic member of the faculty who no longer meets his obligations, you go and offer him a few extra years of retirement, and off they go. For a period of time, let's say 3 years, my suggestion would be sweeten the terms for early retirement and Social Security, make Medicare available to people who are, you know, medically ready to get out but can't afford to do so. And that would do two things. It would make all of those people happier by moving them out of the labor force. If they're already unemployed, they would not have to engage in a futile, frustrating search for jobs they're never going to get. And it would open up those jobs to younger people, to your students, who are at a stage of their life where not having employment that they need is a much more serious matter. Well, those are three ideas. So my suggestion is, at one level, confront the underlying issues that not only gave us this crisis, but are going to give us continued experience of crisis unless we deal with them. And secondly, recognizing that as part of that, you have people facing very difficult transitions, search for simple, common sense things you could do that would affect large numbers of people and change the character of our lives for the better within the limits of the situation that we actually face. If you did that, it seems to me, you would have the extra benefit of creating a policy discussion, or at least one poll of a policy discussion, where the language was sensible, pragmatic, realistic, not overblown, not promising to cure every ill by some magical formula, not promising to restore the past that cannot, in fact, be restored, but in fact something that meets what I think, and I suspect, is very much the actual way in which the large body of the American public realistically and commonsensically views their position and the prospects going forward. By no means hopeless, in fact a very hopeful agenda, but something which I'm afraid is a little bit out of step with the current dialogue in Washington and in the presidential campaign, but then again, you can't have everything. Thank you very much.